Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 198, and some good news. Apple has nominated this podcast as one of South Africa's five shows they liked in 2024. And we're also the third most shared podcast in South Africa on all Apple podcasts. Unbelievable. Ongelooflik. Ngiyamangala and ge makatsoa. I'm delighted and indebted to you, the listeners, who've been sharing this show with friends and family. Thank you, everyone. With that unadulterated self-adulation out of the way, back to 1853. As you know, the series constantly shuffles between world events of the time and incidents and events in southern Africa. In China, the Taiping Rebellion was rolling on in 1853, a civil war between the Manchu-led Qing dynasty and the Hakka-led Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. The war started in 1850. It would only end in 1864. It's believed between 20 and 30 million Chinese died in this war, about the same number who died in World War I. By comparison, the Eighth Frontier War, which had just ended in the Eastern Cape, was trifling, unless, of course, you were one of the 16,000 Amakosa, 1,400 of the British soldiers and settlers who died. The Taiping Heavenly Kingdom was dreamed up by Prophet, just like the Eighth Frontier War. In the Southern African case, Mlanjeni had fused Christian and Amakosa cosmology into a cult-like following. In China, it was Hong Xi Chuan, an ethnic Hakka man, who proclaimed himself to be brother of Jesus Christ and who led the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom. Born into a Hakka family in Guangzhou, Hong claimed to have experienced mystical visions after failing the infamous imperial examinations. During these mystical visions, Hong believed that his celestial father was God the Father, as preached by local missionaries. Hong also made the leap into millenarianism by believing that his celestial brother was Jesus Christ, and he had been directed to rid the world of demon worship. So he rejected Confucianism and began propagating a fusion of Christianity, Taoism, and millenarianism, which Hong presented as a restoration of the ancient Chinese faith in Shangdi. By 1850, Hong's sect had over 10,000 followers and came into conflict with the Qing authorities. The government, dominated by ethnic Manchus, had become increasingly corrupt and was particularly weak in the southern regions of China, where the Hakka community were dominant and very anti-Manchu. Also in 1853, the first passenger railway in India began running between Bombay, or Mumbai, as it's now known, and Tana. In the same year, Manchester was granted city status in the UK, and the first public aquarium opened in London. Yellow fever killed 8,000 Americans in New Orleans. That's one reason why we get yellow fever shots. Because yes, folks, it kills you as quickly as a vaccine hesitant with spasmodic dysphonia. The Swiss company Tissot was founded in 1853, and soon the biggest market for Tissot watches was Russia. Ironic, considering Russia and a host of countries had gone to war in the Crimea. A time to die. In August, New Zealand acquired self-government. This was also on the table in South Africa, as you know. The first potato chips, crisps, chips as we call it here, were prepared and sold by George Crumb in New York. Speaking of crumbs, my car is a veritable sea of salt and vinegar chip crumbs, courtesy of Offspring. Christian Doppler, the Austrian mathematician and physicist, died in 1853, famous for his discovery that the observed frequency of a wave depends on the relative speed of the source and the observer. It's called the Doppler effect. You could argue that there's a Doppler effect in historical views. Just as the perceived pitch of a wave changes with movement, historical events are viewed differently depending on the distance and time from the event. To stretch this metaphor further, perception is influenced by a position shaped by cultural, geographical, and ideological positions. The closer you are to an event, too, the more intense it is, thus the historical Doppler effect. So the Crimean War kicked off in October 1853, and many of the British commanders who'd been fighting the Amakosa in South Africa left to take part in that conflict, including the outgoing governor, Sir George Cathcart, who proceeded, as you know, to die in battle in Inkerman. On other matters, Melbourne Cricket Ground was inaugurated in 1853, and the United States bought 77,000 square kilometres of land from Mexico, which became part of Arizona and New Mexico. known as the Gadsden Purchase. The US coughed up a measly $10 million for this huge expanse of land. But why? Well, as the railroad age evolved, business-orientated southerners saw that railways linking the south with the Pacific coast could expand trade opportunities and avoid the northeast. They thought the topography, though, of the southern portion of the original Mexican cession was too mountainous. They wanted flatter land and therefore bought the Mexican land. And Mexico had just lost the Mexican-American War in 1848, and that government was flat broke. So they sold their land to their previous enemies. Cash is king, you know. In South Africa, the tension was growing between colonists who supported indentured labour and others who supported the idea of individual human rights. In the US, this period is 7 years before the disastrous American Civil War. So all these wheelings and dealings have cross-cutting motivations and ethics. Word of these events, of course, rippled across the planet, sometimes taking months to reach the furthest corners. The Boers in South Africa, for example, were acutely aware of the Crimean War and that their enemy, the English, were involved. It's an important moment to take stock following the end of the Eighth Frontier War in South Africa. What had also become clear was that the two Khoi Khoi and coloured villages in the Cut River settlement, Philipton and Theophilus, had been lost to their original owners. The peace settlement in 1853 after the Eighth Frontier War indicated something else, the extent to which the frontier had now shifted away from the coast and into the interior. On the coast, there were more Amaxhosa groups who'd supported the British, the Amamtlambe keeping the roads between the Port of East London and King Williamstown open. They kept their land. The war years had seen the rise of these towns as entrepot and distributory centres for the frontier, and a borderland in turmoil was to their benefit, as Norman Pollock and Swansea Agnew point out in their wonderful Historical Geography of South Africa work, published in 1973. Each frontier war had led to more money and material flowing through these two towns, East London and King Williamstown, and a corresponding expansion in their size and importance. After peace, their very survival at times was challenged. The coastal belt of the Eastern Cape was now to be more firmly separated by historic river lines, and the density of settlements rose west of the Kai River. On the other hand, the interior, along the escarpment foot and in the plateau and basins to the north, had seen considerable change. Here the Amangika of Makoma were evicted, so too the Khoi Khoi and Coloureds, and the people of the Middle Kai were moved further east, or in some cases across the Kai River itself. The British military was combing the Amangika territory of the Tumi, the Kaiskama and the Buffalo Headwater Valleys for remnants of any raiding warriors who may have ignored the peace treaty. Pockets continued to operate, but they were harried away and disappeared over the Kai. These areas of the Amatolas were finally declared a Royal Forest Reserve by the Governor Sir George Cathcart before he left for the Crimea. As I explained last episode, he did that to stop land-hungry settlers from seizing the forests previously inhabited by the Amaxhosa. Many of the settlers were seething about that, but once it was declared Royal Forest, anyone caught inside shooting the plethora of animals that abounded there could technically be executed. The Royal Forest was guarded by a string of forts and military posts located along the rim of the escarpment, where it was thought that the Amangika warriors may try to return by the high ground back door, so to speak. What this means is that the boundary of the forest reserve was drawn on a very basic map, and the line ran across the foot of the escarpment, cutting across a range of spurs, outcrops of the mountain. This in turn meant that the settlements that grew from now on were dominated by two different peoples. Along the face of the escarpment was the forest. Below the forest was the Amamtlambe and the Amakunukwebe land, and above the forest was settler land. The colonists had mountain farms on the plateau above the escarpment rim, defined by two roads along the east and south of the forest, both leading from King Williamstown, and along these roads the British reinforced their positions. Above the rim, on the escarpment, each new farm sold to a settler could not be more than 3,000 acres in size, and the farmers were subject to a quit rent. That is a historical form of land tenure, property tax, where the owner or occupier of land pays a regular fee to the government instead of performing duties and services. The payment was usually made annually and allowed the landholder to quit other obligations tied to the land, such as building roads or military service. The VOC had forced farmers to fight with them against the Khoi, the San and the Amaxhosa, and the British had repeated this. Now the new farmers could pay a quit rent and no longer be called out to commando. This quit rent system increased revenue for the British, while allowing the landowner some form of autonomy. The British also insisted that every farm was owner-occupied. There could be no sub-leasing going on, a rule that further alienated the Boer farmers from this region. They often subleased or chopped up land to distribute to their sons. The new district of Queenstown, alongside the Forest Reserve, was English-speaking, and the town itself of the same name was to be the centre of this new administrative district. A huge new area of land was offered to white settlers north of the Amatola and Escarpment Rim, and for the first time the Great Kei River was pretty much ignored as a firm boundary line between white and black people, because the Great Kei in this area of the plateau is broken into several headwaters. Where did the Great Kei actually begin? There was some debate. North of the rim, the land was drier, and Queenstown was chosen because it commands the eastern and northern approaches to this drier basin on the highland, above the temperate mist belt of the Amatola Winterberg Mountains. If you stood on the hills to the west of Queenstown and looked further west in 1853, you would have stared out at spectacular mesas dotting the land leading directly towards Craddock, which had already been settled. So Queenstown was an early warning town, vigilant of any threat to goods flowing back and forth between the Cape and the interior. The new settlers in this land to the north were new buffers, backdoor defences in a place that was going to be easier to defend than the tangle of valleys the settlers had been trying to build their homes in across the Albany district around Grahamstown. South of the Royal Reserve Forest, no settler would be permitted to buy land, but the British were going to build military villages inside the reserve. Wink, wink. These villages had been a bit of a hit and miss during the Eighth Frontier War. They were isolated, badly located, set up too far from water, easy to attack. If you remember previous podcasts, I explained that most of these along the Tumi Valley were ransacked by Macomb's warriors and then abandoned. Soldiers returned to these posts, and the governor, while disallowing direct land ownership, did allow settlers to take up small holdings within the precincts of these military posts. And thus, Keiskamahoek was born within the Royal Reserve. The town of Alice, which is going to loom large in our tale, also experienced growth as settlers moved into small holdings here. These small holdings allowed settlers access to commonage, where they could graze their cattle and sheep. So while they were not farms in the strict sense, they were farms. And importantly, the land was shifting in ownership. Cathcart's rule that no settlers should be allowed to buy land within the reserve and the areas demarcated for the Amakunukwebe or the Amamfengu or Amamklambe was being subsumed by reality. In early 1854, for example, Amamfengu loyalists who'd fought with the British against the Amangika were granted villages of 20 huts or larger within this forest reserve. Each householder was to pay quit rent of 10 shillings a year for the garden plot, and they were allowed to run their cattle, sheep and goats on the commonage. The head of each household, this group of 20 huts or more, could run 10 head of cattle on the commonage max. In this way, the British administration added another layer of protection on their frontier, a string of loyal Bantu-speaking people on a line from the military post called Auckland at the very top of the Tumi River Basin to the coast at Pedi. They were going to act like a sponge against invasion, a human mangrove swamp against the tide of people moving towards the colony. These people would be the line, as the British saw it, between the settlers and barbarous tribes. A boundary line between black and white. But it was a boundary line that would continuously be redrawn to the disadvantage of the Amamfengu. This line, or wall, if you prefer, was designed to keep outsiders out. It was a literal line on a map, not just a line in the sand, a partition between the civilized colonists and the barbarians outside. And yet, coming our way, dear listener, was a new governor who was going to upend some of this thinking, Sir George Grey. Arriving in 1854, he reversed the defensive policy of Sir George Cathcart. Grey believed in introducing black people to what he called the benefits of civilization, and more than that, he believed in integrating people into the economy of the colony. And why do that, you ask? Well, the main reason was so that they could contribute to the annual revenue of British Kaffraria, in other words, pay for the British military forts by buying the goods sold by British merchants and by providing cheap labour to expand production on farms. Win-win, you know, old chap. Education was to be promoted. The industrial schools, which had been mooted by Cathcart and some missionaries, were established in Hilton, Lovedale, Shiloh, Lesserton, Salem, St. Matthews, and Mount Coke. Time to swing back inland, swivel our telescope northwards to peer with narrowed eyes at the distant interior. It's difficult these days, to continue the Doppler effect metaphor on history, to understand that in the perspective of the British ruling class, the Cape Colony was of marginal value in the middle years of the 19th century. Its strategic value was confined to the harbours of the Cape Peninsula, which were important links on the trade route to the jewel in the crown called India. That was because India was the most profitable of all British possessions. For the rest, the Cape Colony was a burden, the black sheep of the white colonial family. Its civil administration costs could barely be met. The military costs were exorbitant, and these were being borne by the English taxpayer. There weren't enough English settlers in South Africa to sway British politics about the region, and the Cape's trade with Britain was of little value. By 1853, the British wanted to wash their hands of as much as possible of any direct involvement in any territory outside of the Cape, and this position was to have an acute effect on the Boers. In Natal, for example, things were dire by 1850. Governor Pine there had tried to entice settlers. Few arrived. Some left Natal soon after arriving. They were so shocked by conditions. One unfortunate example of a family in 1851 was that they took a look at Natal, re-embarked on the ship that brought them, then lost their lives when the ship sank on its way back to England. Fate is a cruel tyrant. Thus, the British stopped further speculative immigration to Natal in that year, and by now, in the north of Natal, by now I mean 1853, there were more Boers than English. The bubble of Englishness around Durban was constantly reinforced by the few that were there, distinguishing themselves and parts of their city from all other territories in South Africa, except a part of the southeastern portion of the Cape Colony. Separate from the Dutch speakers too, the future Afrikaans. To the north, land speculators had gobbled up as much of the Free State as possible. One English settler there, called Green, gathered up a massive 160,000 acres. Another explained he'd been given 60,000 acres by Harry Smith and decided to name this vast territory The Hope. As in The Hope, no one will notice how he'd been handed a piece of territory the size of Malta. Well, the British were very good at noticing they were spending vast amounts, £10 per head of the population, to protect mostly Boers there in the Free State who sympathised with anyone other than the British. The Orange River Sovereignty Delegates met in 1853 and demanded a constitution under the Crown similar to the Cape Colony. The new British agent in Bloemfontein was Sir George Clark. 95 delegates, of whom three quarters were Dutch, confronted Sir George. They demanded that Clark sort out the border squabbles with Moshoeshoe of the Basutu and the Griqua leader Adam Cook before the British pulled out completely. The signing of the Sand River Convention in 1852 led Basutu chief Moshoeshoe coming to the conclusion that it was a fight or flight moment that awaited his people. Up until then, he'd toyed with both the Boers and the British, but once the British signed the convention and began to withdraw from the Orange River sovereignty, Moshoeshoe pounced on Sekonyele's Batlokwa, as well as their Kora and Griqua allies. After the signing of the Sand River Convention, the Batlokwa and Kora and Griqua had gone into overdrive themselves, raiding Basutu cattle with abandon. At last, Moshoeshoe could endure it no longer and fell on the disturbers of the peace. In 1853, he drove them from their strongholds in a series of raids and battles, dispersing them, with the result that virtually all Sotho speakers who remained in the Caledon River Valley area were directly under his control. He left the Wesleyan missionaries at Tabanchu and the Platberg alone, but virtually everyone else was either kowtowing to Moshoeshoe, exiled or dead. The only chief in the region still cocking a snook at Moshoeshoe was Maroka of the Rolong people who lived at Tabanchu, next door to the missionaries. Meanwhile, sovereignty delegates, the 95, of whom three quarters were Boers, harangued Clark about their own constitution. Clark hedged, fudged, fumbled, not to mention mumbled and played for time. Clark met with Moshoeshoe and afterwards the Burger delegates. The Basutu chief offered a compromise in the Caledon area, where his claims were the weakest. The Burgers rejected the compromise. When Moshoeshoe heard after the meeting that the Free State delegates were privately against any definite boundary, He then claimed the whole of what was known as the Napier Line of 1853, including the Caledon Valley. It so happened that the Burghers had indeed made it clear they did not desire a definite boundary with the Basutu and were prepared to revert to pre-annexation relations with Moshoeshoe. Clark once again fudged and smudged and then simply dropped the matter, kicked the can down the road. Confusion reigned. Clark feigned. The Burghers fumed. Moshoeshoe presumed. Peace was doomed. We'll join the can clattering and clunking, careening crookedly down the dusty dirt road next episode, where we'll hear about the steady movement towards the significant Bloemfontein Convention. We were convention-obsessed people, no doubt about it. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platform that helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm going to load an update about the series. You can email me from there or sign up for a little newsletter. Until next, Salagathi.